Guess who has a new book out? Michael Perry.
Yeah.
It's for young people this time. What do they call those? Young adult books? Are they young adults or old children at that point? Anyway, it's called The Scavengers. You're welcome, please, to our very stage here. We caught in between book tours. Michael Perry. Where is he? I'm gesturing this way. I'll gesture this way just in case. Michael Perry. There he is, Michael Perry. You took off your backpack. I'm relieved to see that. That's, you know, you must be on the road like every day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty glamorous life. I got the used Fambulance. I refuse to call it a mini, you know what, because a guy like me, this cool and hip, would not have one of those. But so I have a Fambulance.
Yeah, Fambulance. Yeah. That's cool. And I did notice the gratuitous use of Bon Iver in your book.
Yeah, there's an Easter egg in there. So this is a book. Yeah. They told me that it's for tweens. The editors, the people
tweens.
Who hired me to write the book, said it's for tweens, and that's apparently between fifth grade and eighth grade, in that general range.
Okay.
I, of course, wrote it for tweens between 9 and 90, give or take a couple years on either end, because I'm concerned about the bottom line.
The bottom line.
Yeah.
But the bone hiver.
But I did throw a little. Yeah. So what I tried to do as a father now for 11 years, who's been consuming firsthand and secondhand a lot of media targeted towards a younger audience, I do know that the best ones always have a little something in there for the grown-ups.
Yeah.
And so there are certain little bits of humor in the book that are targeted for that crew. And the Bon Hiver reference, Maggie, the main character, her father's favorite T-shirt is a Bon Hiver.
Yeah.
And that goes back to this fella from up where I'm at. His name is Justin Vernon, and he had a band called Bon Iver. And he told me one time that it's French for good winter, but the true spelling is B-O-N space H-I. V-E-R, and Justin told me once he took the H off because he thought it would be too confusing.
Yeah.
I don't think he fixed the problem.
Yeah.
And so I just, with his permission, he had a great sense of humor about it. I thought it was just
because you wanted to be in the band.
Memorizing
songs, references in your book.
He used to be in my band, if you want to know the truth.
Did he really?
Yeah, he'll come crawling back.
Yeah. When was that then?
Oh, man, back when I first started. He played my wedding.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was a long bed. I have a band called The Long Beds.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, he gave me one of the most important pieces of musical advice I've ever received. When I first started playing music, I had no business doing it. I was just writing songs as a way to break up the tedium of writing books. And I had all these songs, and my buddy Billy, who's been playing for years, said, "Man, you got to play out." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm too nervous." And he said, "No, you got to do it." So he booked us into a coffee shop, and my standard line is, I ain't saying I was nervous, but I ripped out a 60-minute set in 32 minutes flat. But anyway, people asked us back, and so eventually I put a band together, and at the time, Justin was just this kid living in a basement, and he and I recorded my first album together. He basically played everything, and you know, I was just the pretty face up front, So he was in my band, and one time I'd get so nervous before we played, and then one time we were way up in Grand Marais playing this auditorium, and there was actually a pretty big crowd, and it was the first time where I felt like I knew the music well enough that I wasn't just a wreck. I was actually looking forward to playing, and so the band is out there behind me. I come out. It's an open E chord. I'm strumming it, you know, walking up to the microphone. You know, I ain't going to lie to you. I was pretending I was Waylon Jennings. And I'm just strumming that E chord and feeling control. And so as any band leader would, I turn back just to check in with the band, make sure they're with me. And I could see Justin nodding his head in reverse, you know, that thing like, "Come here, come here." And so being a professional at this point, I didn't stop playing. I just kept playing. I eased back and I leaned over and Justin said, "Plug in your guitar."
Always good musical advice. Oh, well. But you've gone on other chords besides the E, haven't you?
I have. Yeah. I've
what are you up to?
Well, D is my favorite. Yeah. I have a pretty solid relationship with D-A-G. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I didn't realize there's all that connection. Well, that's very cool. And he's done so well since
being in your band. I think it's only fair that I say we're all very happy for him. I feel like, you know, that whole group, Sean and Justin, that whole crew, I'm kind of like the clunky uncle.
Yeah.
I'm the old bald guy who just kind of hung around and watched them all do this. Cool. And it's only natural that when someone like Justin has the success he did, that you want to maybe claim a little piece of that. Yeah. So I'm here to tell you today that I'm actually the opposite of that. So I'd known Justin for a long time. Anyone who knows him, he's got a beautiful, deep, resonant voice, and he can sing like a 70-year-old Delta blues man. Mm-hmm. And then he went into the woods to do this Forema album, deep into the northern Wisconsin wood, 9 miles to the nearest Quick Trip. and he emerges with this album, and he gives it to me and says, "Would you please listen to it and tell me what you think?" And so I listened to it, and then I went back, and musically I said, I think it's terrific. I think this is what you needed to do. Congratulations. But I said, but this whole singing in falsetto thing, that seems like a pretty bad idea.
You warned him about that.
That's right. So I'm the guy. He ignored me and is now doing fine.
See, his advice to you was good, by comparison.
Yeah, oh, actually, his was actually useful. Mine was the, thank goodness he ignored me.
That's pretty funny. You don't do any falsetto when you're...
No.
So then, writing, there's something in you that is an audacious 12-year-old girl.
It was time.
Yeah.
You know.
It was time.
Yeah. I'm through hiding it. Yeah.
And she's quite the hero of this is Ford Falcon.
Yeah, her name is Maggie. Yeah. And she's this fiercely independent young lady who's in very tough circumstances, has to fend for herself. She doesn't have recourse to magic or unicorns or anything like that. She just has to figure things out herself. But she scavenges for a living. Mm-hmm. She and her father work in this ravine, and whatever they can find, they take to town and they barter with it.
Because it is a post-apocalyptic.
That's what they tell me. I hear the word dystopian a lot.
Dystopian.
Yeah, I had to look it up after I started writing the book.
I take something for that.
Someone said, "That's a dystopian novel," and I said, yeah.
Oh, I have dyspepsia. That's different.
You can have that removed.
Dystopian.
Matter of fact, I can do it. I'm still licensed registered nurse in the state of Wisconsin.
Okay, well, maybe another time. We'll save that for the next trip.
We got a table here and everything. Yeah. So let's. Yeah. Sean, scrub up.
Yeah.
He'll play something beatific while I take out your dystopia.
Oh, my God. I'm not even sure what would end up with her on the table.
It's gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, it's gone horribly.
So the young girl, Maggie, at one point, she's like a lot of kids that age. She loves her family, but she likes her time apart. And so she discovers while she's scavenging this old Ford Falcon station wagon hidden in the brush, and that becomes where she hangs out. That's where she stays. And at one point, she realizes, I'm going to have to change myself if I'm going to survive in this world. And so she crawls up on the hood of the old station wagon, and she puts her hands on her hips and takes a wide stance with her steel-toed boots and tells the world from here forward she will be known as Ford Falcon. Right. And that's her name for the rest of the book. Yeah. Except her mom refuses to call her anything but Maggie.
Yeah. So this dystopia here, this world here, is an interesting world in that something has happened. We don't really know what has happened.
We don't really know.
But there are these bubble cities that the government has set up. It's certainly pretty profoundly anti-government of any sort, obviously.
No,
of course not. Yeah. Okay, stop me when I'm wrong. Yeah. And you did.
Well, it's anti-government and big business getting too friendly with each other.
Agribusiness.
Yeah, not that would ever happen.
No.
What happened? You know, so you have a choice. You do have free will. You can choose to live out bubble or under bubble. And if you live under bubble, everything's taken care of, but someone else is in charge of you. If you live out bubble, as Maggie and her family do, you have freedom, but you have to fend for yourself.
Right.
The thing is, when I pitched the story, I wrote a proposal and many scenes and everything, and I described that quite literally that the cities were enclosed in these big, clear bubbles. And I got the deal, I signed the contract, and 2 months later, Stephen King released a book called Under the Dome. And so there's...
He was a fly in the wall.
I told my editor, I said, well, first of all, no one's going to believe I came up with it on my own. And right. Secondly, Steve's lawyers are so much better than mine. And so there's a line early in the book where this old character, Toad, tells the young Hickey, don't believe everything you read. And that becomes significant in relation to the Bubble Cities.
In relationship to Stephen King as well?
Well, Steve and I have never actually spoken.
But yeah. Okay, so it's an interesting idea. And then there's this other thing, you know, I'm not saying... I was thinking ConAgra, but that's not. It's called your corn.
Urcorn, yeah. Your corn.
You are corn.
Yeah.
You are or your corn. Yeah. Which is a crop that is grown by the authorities and by the agriculture business.
Yes, the government decided to make sure everybody got fed. They and the largest corporation would get together and just take care of all of us. And they have this corn that's been modified and. It's got a lot of interesting things in it. For instance, you can plant it during cold weather because they've taken the little chemical that is in ladybugs, Asian beetles, that keeps them from freezing over the winter. And then
we call them ladybugs.
That's right.
That.
and they have spliced that into the corn, and so that the corn won't be hurt by frost.
That was a pretty good idea, though.
Well,
that probably could be done.
Thank you. I'm working on the patent right now.
But it's green and it's inedible, actually.
It's inedible, and you don't find out why until partway through the book.
Yeah,
and, when Maggie tries to eat some, she becomes violently ill.
Yeah.
But in order to eat it, you have to have this thing called the Activax, which, coincidentally enough, is sold by the same conglomeration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's a whole thing.
I got so lost. I had no idea. Yeah. This fiction apparently involves a plot. I was unprepared for that. Yeah, I had great fun creating Maggie and attack roosters and all these odd characters. And then at some point they said, well, it kind of needs to wrap up at the end.
Yeah.
Thank goodness there's a sequel. So is there? Yeah, there's a scene on the second to last or final chapter where the main character, Maggie/Ford Falcon, reflects on everything that has transpired. And she has a lot of questions. And those are my questions, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the second book.
One of the things I like about it, and I like a lot of things about it, is the American Boy's Handy Book. Now, this is something you must have had, right, as a child. Did you have access to American Boy's Handy Book?
Yeah, I have a copy on my desk.
Yeah.
The American Boy's Handy Book, which is written in late 1800s, early 1900s, by a friend of Mark Twain's, actually. So at one point, there's this octogenarian fellow named Toad who befriends Maggie and gives her a lot of advice, and she works for him and helps him. And at one point, he gives her this book and says, if you're going to survive in this world, you need to read this book. It's filled with all kinds of useful information, how to make your own raft, how to make your own weapons, how to make boomerangs. And she takes it from him, and of course, it says the American Boy's Handy Book.
Right.
And she becomes somewhat indignant about that. He prevails upon her to read it anyway because he said, yes, I understand, but there's still good information.
Yeah.
In there, and then she comes across a sentence where the guy's telling her how to make a bow and arrow, and then he said, there's a line where he just says, but girls won't be interested, they just want pretty things from the store. And Maggie goes off on Toad and brings him up to speed.
Because she's really a 50-year-old man.
Yeah, right. 49, thank you very much.
But, you know, it's like, I like it because, like, girl is the new boy.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I have two daughters. I have a 14-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I learn so much from them.
Yeah.
But I also wonder about the world that they're growing up in and what will await them. And
But also, like, the new heroes will be girl. It makes sense.
Why not? It's time.
Yeah, it's definitely time. Okay, and so that's cool. And she is definitely much into that, and a lot of things that she concocts, the spit sticks, the jack lights, the boomerangs, the mini boomerangs, actually become very handy in this sort of thing.
Yeah, just about everything she builds, she winds up using for some reason, or even there's instructions in that book how to build a stove, an oven, out of slate rock and mud, and of course, way at the end of the book, suddenly you realize why she built that particular stove and what she learned, and it becomes integral to the plot that I eventually had to develop.
Did you have to backfit a plot into that? I mean,
there was some retrofitting.
Retrofitting,
yes.
Yeah.
There were some moments like that.
Yeah. And then, okay, and then actually quite a bit is going on here. And then these gray people, I must say that was...
The Gray Devils.
The Gray Devils.
The Gray Devils are disturbing. Several reviewers have referred to them as zombies, and they're not zombies, but I can see why you might think they are.
Yeah.
And partway through the book, they are partially explained, but to really figure out what they are, you'll have to read the sequel.
You got this all right.
I got no idea.
Okay.
But yeah, they're a little intimidating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, and this other thing, just maybe apart from the plot and all that kind of thing, the mother in this book. Hmm. Now, because I noticed in one of your columns, he's a columnist now, too. Did you know that?
Yeah, every week I got to write a column. That's a problem.
Just one a week? That's not so bad.
Yeah.
You got a lot of stuff to recycle. Come on.
Well, I got to come up with stuff every week, and people say, "Is that hard?" And I go, "Well, no. Usually, I just wait for one of my brothers to call."
Yeah. And you put that.
I do. I mean, my brother called the other day, and he called to tell me he'd been working on his grinder, and he got shot in the neck. It exploded, and it put a big hole in his neck. Just missed his carotid.
Oh my God!
I know. And I said it was one of those deals. It was an eighth of an inch between a memorial service and a really excellent column.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that
can't
happen every week, though. You must actually. I mean, you can.
No, but you know,
stuff that
just
you've
about
written, you know, chicken coops and
the next week, my brother the logger got hurt while logging. And I was like, I appreciate the
How
their
many brothers you got? You only got.
I got two, but at the pace they keep, it's sufficient, really.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Anyhow, I was gonna say when it comes about your mother, your mom is on the book tour with you, which I guess was like.
Metaphorically speaking, yes. Yeah.
And then I look at the mother in this book here, and I'm wondering if there isn't some relationship between that your mother and this woman who reads to her children. There are very few books left in the world. She has a few books, Emily Dickinson and so forth, and she has those books, and they're like treasures. And she doesn't want her kids to drop the G's on their words.
Right.
That sort of thing. So is that related to your mom?
Yes. I mean, there's always the question when you write fiction, as I'm discovering, how much of it is true and how much is drawn from your real life. And I make no bones about the fact that the mother in the book, any scene where Maggie is sitting with her mother and they're sharing a book is directly drawn from my own childhood. My mother changed my life with books. I was raised in an obscure fundamentalist Christian sect. I like to say that because it makes people uncomfortable. It was actually quite gentle, but one of the deals was no TV in the house, no movies, no dancing, no fun.
Right.
And so, but my mother was a voracious reader. She filled the house with books. She took us
to
the little
library.
Did
she read Emily Dickinson to you?
She did not read Emily Dickinson to me. She started with Winnie the Pooh. That was a little more my speed. But she taught me to read when I was very, very young, and when I was 4 years old, and just filled my world with books. And 20-some years later, that changed my life, because when I accidentally wound up writing, I write by ear from reading all those books and from my mom reading to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to tell the story about knowing how to read when I was four, and I was telling it recently at a family get-together. My dad's a real quiet guy. He doesn't say much, but he's sitting down at the end of the table, and I said, yeah, I could read when I was four, and I hear my dad say, well, kinda. What do you mean, kind? And he said, well, I remember when you were four, you were very proud of being able to read then, as apparently you still are. And he said, and I remember you were telling everybody you met you could read, and he said, but I took you to the barn one day, and the neighbor's truck was parked there, and you stopped behind the tailgate, and you said, F-O-R-D, truck.
Well, that's more than kind of, then, isn't it? Yeah. And what about the dropping of the gerunds and dropping the G's on words? Did your mom ever?
My mom was actually not that tough. To me talk.
Okay.
I love language, and I love the sounds and the things we do with it. And I like that Maggie's mother cares about language, because I tend to go both ways writing. I write a lot like I talk when I'm down at the fire department, because that's comfortable for me, like old blue jeans. Mm. But poets and visual artists have changed my life, and poetry is my favorite form. I love to read poetry, and so I love beautiful language. And sometimes I'm criticized for going back and forth between the two. And my response to that is, why let the fancy people have all the fancy words? And so
And Bon Iver, you know.
Right. So
not even English.
French for almost good winter. Yeah. So he, so Maggie's mom, I just, the gerunds thing, first of all, it's fun to explain what a gerund is because I was about 42 before I knew what one was. And I thought it was a small African antelope. But
that's a gerbil, I think. Okay.
But and don't drop your gerbils either, by the way.
Definitely not. Because you get it on the table here, you get those out, really.
But yeah, I just thought it was nice that and the point she's trying to make, she isn't so much being snooty about language. She's just saying, look, just because we're living in this rough environment doesn't mean we have to be rough. We can appreciate beautiful things, and that's my life.
And you know what? It's so much like people who've been displaced everywhere. Trying to take their civilization, their culture with them, you know, and you know, people all over the world who get displaced and whatever, and they have to take what's on their back and go somewhere and survive and scavenge and so forth, but they want to take their culture with them, and so she's so much like that, you know.
Yeah, it was so important for her to that her children would have books, even if it were only two books.
Yeah, yeah, so that was cool. And the thing about, you know, finding these objects that no longer exist. Because they're in a world where none of this actually exists anymore, and they have vague memories of living in a house and having things. Yeah. But, you know, and she uncovers that Porky Pig bank or something like that, you know, a kid's bank, and it's so significant because it becomes like a time machine.
It does. She holds it in her hands and begins to understand the idea of nostalgia, and it turns out late in the book that becomes a very critical part of the plot, which I eventually developed under duress. And that actually came, my grandmother had an old Porky Pig bank when she was a little girl, and I got it when she died, and it's been sitting on my bookcase. And so
yeah,
when
I was about that too.
Yeah, and we have a ravine behind our farm where the farmers for decades threw all their junk. And right. On the one hand, it's an environmental disaster. On the other hand, my kids love it because it's this archaeological dig. You can just go out there and find things. And someone came to interview me a couple of weeks ago, and I took them out there and I dug up a trike, and they took a picture of it, you know, and so. So it was.
There's a column in there.
Oh yeah, there's a column in anything, man. I was like, I need all the help I can get. I hope my brothers are listening.
Yeah, that's really good.
So yeah, there's that sense of discovery, and that's part of what was fun about writing this character, because I still remember how much I loved books and I loved wordplay and I loved the adventure of discovering unexpected things, and that's what that ravine where she and her father scavenge. Right. They're constantly discovering.
And looking for an unbroken pane of glass.
Yes, because her father has promised to put a real window in the shack because her mother dreams of the day when she can sit beside a window and read a book again.
Again, yeah. No, but some of the things, now the girl, like she said, for example, I feel like I've been dipped in lard and rolled in seeds.
Yes. Well, that's in reference to,
yes.
I knew I wanted to have chickens in the book.
Yes.
Because I got chickens. I like chickens, you know. I mean, they're just pigs with feathers, but they're interesting. And so I had chickens in the book, but they weren't really holding their own as characters. And then one day I went to feed my real chickens, and we have a rooster, and he could never finish his crows. He would say, cock-a-doodle! But you remember I said...
Choke up on him.
Yeah, he just started hacking. And so you remember I said I wanted to have some things in there for the adults as well. And the thing that really intrigues me about this rooster isn't so much that he can't finish his crows, but that it completely does nothing to diminish his male ego. So he does a pathetic half crow, but then he puffs his chest out and struts around like he's God's gift to chickens. I'm like, dude, you can't even crow. And... So I put one of the supporting characters is a rooster named Hatchet, who is a trained attack rooster.
Attack rooster.
He has his own armor, and but she has an ambivalent relationship, Maggie/Ford Falcon, because she needs Hatchet when they are attacked by the Grey Devils. He helps protect them. But then when the Grey Devils are gone, he just starts attacking her, which anyone who knows anything about roosters, that's what they do, and that's why she feels like a piece of, just like she's been dipped in lard and rolled in seeds, because he's just constantly
attacking. Now, I'm curious, is that a common expression?
It is now, yeah.
Has that been said before?
If it has, I don't know.
Because I think you might have started something.
I remember when I came up with that, it was about 2 in the morning, and I was pretty much just as proud of myself as when I said F-O-R-D, truck.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
I thought that's a pretty good one.
I know. I wrote it down, so it's very effective.
You validated me.
I can't. Or,
I don't know if you'll just validate
my partner. How about tan his hide and use it for a trampoline?
Yeah, man, that's mine. I don't know. I do. I spend some time on this stuff. I cross things out and start over even, you know?
I know.
Yeah.
You figure those sayings that have to start somewhere, you know? Usually yeah. think like in a prison. Some guy says something in a prison and it gets out somewhere.
It's just my dream to be in Bartlett's sometime before everyone forgets what Bartlett's was.
Who said tan his hide and use it for a trampoline? Anyone?
Okay. That was me.
That'll be you.
I'll be right next to FDR or somebody. Yeah.
What sort of feedback have you had from kids, especially girls, reading your book?
Well, so far they're showing up. This book tour has been different for me. I do about 3 to 5 school stops every day, and then at night I do the standard book. What do they call them? Bookstores.
Bookstores.
Yeah, which I'm
stores. Yeah,
I should learn more about those.
Yeah, it should be important.
And I stopped there, but yeah, there are young folks coming to the readings, and I'm getting so far good feedback. My favorite bit of young person feedback: there's a character in here called Toad, and he speaks in word tricks.
Yeah, and dyslexic.
Latin, spoonerisms.
Yeah.
And I, right at the end, I almost took all of his text or all of his dialogue out and made it more straightforward because I knew it would be chewy and that I'd get criticized for it. Mm-hmm. But just recently, there was a wonderful little review where a mother and a daughter read the book together and then did their review in the form of a Q&A. Mm. And at one point, the mother said, well, I found that the Toad character, sometimes he was a little hard to understand. Mm. And bless her heart, the young girl said, well, for grown-ups, maybe.
The Scavengers, Michael Perry. Get it, read it, give it to your kids, buy it to your folks.
Thank you, Michael.
As always, thank you for coming by. Michael Perry. You got one back there. You got one.